What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Malo atau matwe bongbong ini ko au egi tupo mehe Pacific Beat o leti o ABC Radio Australia. Good morning to all our listeners. Thank you so much for tuning in. I must say it's great to be back from the motherland of Vava'u Tonga, but I'm also grateful for the team for looking after the show while I was away. Well, let's get on with it. On the show today, there's controversy over Solomon Islands wanting to create its own defence force.
The government should consult the people first before making any decision.
Samoa's new government has finally passed their national budget, and a new warning from environmental experts that invasive species in the Pacific are threatening the region's efforts to cope with climate change.
So taro vine is a big broadleaf vine which attaches itself to other trees, and it's very successful by suckering and forming dense infestations, eventually killing all the plants.
All that and more shortly. But before we start, though, we'd like to acknowledge that Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Again, I'm your host, Aggie Dubon, and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, across the Pacific, the concept of small island countries having their own defence forces is a vexed and complex issue. Fiji, PNG and Tonga have their own forces. Others, like Solomon Islands, rely on their police forces and the security provided with defence agreements with countries such as Australia, New Zealand or even China. But if one high-ranking Solomon Islands MP gets his way in his country, this could change. The country's police minister is pushing for Solomon Islands to create its own defence force. And the idea has received some support from parliamentarians. But as Solomon Islands reporter Krisnarita Almanuliong reports, on the streets of the capital, Honiara, it's also creating controversy. Now please note, this story contains sound effects that may be triggering.
It was a dark time in Solomon Islands' history. From 1999 to 2003, its ethnic conflict, known as the Tensions, which saw hundreds killed, and sections of the country's paramilitary unit using guns from the police armory were to blame. For many Solomon Islanders, these memories are still fresh.
The paramilitary setup wasn't the issue. The issue was them breaking the trust that the people had.
I was scared for my life.
It is in this context that some are questioning the idea for the country to create its own army.
Defense force law country.
Having a defense force in our country is such a huge undertaking.
I think I'm here big too much, yeah.
So only if we got some trigger.
What's the trigger that's prompting us to need a force?
The government should consult the people first before making any decision.
This idea is not new. In 2023, former Prime Minister Manase Songavare suggested that the country might set up its own military force, with IDEA receiving support from Australia's government. In a recent speech in the country's parliament, Jimson Tananganda, the country's police and security minister, has started a new push.
So there's no fixed time frame, but the agency is there given the evolving security challenges in the face. This initiative is not about militarization, it's about nation building and development, preparing our country for future challenges while maintaining peace, law and democratic oversight.
Yet the country's opposition leader, Matthew Wale, argues that Solomon Islands must learn from its own civil conflict.
And, you know, Fiji, of course, there has been a number of coups.
Professor Wallace says the government must involve parliamentarians from across the political divide to have control over this initiative. And he asks, if the government wants to pursue the plan, what are the risks?
The first one perhaps is financial, because it's, you know, militaries, defence forces are expensive things to set up.
James Batley is the Distinguished Policy Fellow at the Australian National University and a former Australian High Commissioner in Solomon Islands. He says the government needs to identify where funds would come from to establish this type of force.
You can also find situations where the defence force and the police force almost see themselves as in competition, and that could be a potential risk, that the establishment of a defence force doesn't necessarily contribute to domestic stability. Perhaps it's also a source of instability if it starts to compete with the police force for funding, for prestige, for position, for roles.
If the government were to go down this path, he says it would attract interest from its existing security partners.
And I think Australia would be very keen to be involved to help Solomons with the establishment and the running of the Defence Force. Having said that, I think that there are other security partners would also want to play a role. And obviously, I think New Zealand as a partner. But also, I think it's possible that China would want to contribute to the development of a defence force.
Mr. Batley was also leader of the Regional Assistance Mission to Solomon Islands, better known as RAMSI, during the country's recovery from the tensions. He says the key will be whether the government can build trust to build its own defence force again.
So I think the government will be very conscious of the need to ensure that there is community confidence in any decisions that are taken about the shape of the security structures in the country.
And that's James Batley, the man who once led the Regional Assistance Mission to Solomon Islands, better known as RAMSI, now Distinguished Policy Fellow at the Australian National University. Ending that report by ABC's reporter Chris Narita Almanuliong in Solomon Islands. And just to note, if any of the content in this story has brought anything up for you, please reach out or speak to someone you trust.
Join Natasha Metin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
When it comes to obesity prevention efforts, it's really important that it is a combination of diet, exercise, and intense counseling that comes with it.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Noa'ia e Māori and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, Pacific climate advocates are hoping a recent historic ruling by the International Court of Justice will have an impact at the upcoming UN climate talks. In an advisory opinion in July, the ICJ clarified that states do have a legal obligation to prevent global warming. The team that brought the case to court are mostly hopeful it will help generate meaningful action at next month's gathering, known as COP30 in Brazil. Lucy Cooper filed this report.
The countdown is on. Only 11 days until COP30. And this year, Pacific leaders and the delegation from across the region are arriving armed with a new bargaining chip.
This is going to be the first climate summit since the International Court of Justice handed down its landmark advisory opinion. And with expectations running high, it changes how we approach this conference.
That's Vishal Prasad of Pacific Islands Students Fighting Climate Change, the group that spearheaded the ICJ case.
Every year, visibly, things are getting worse, while the annual gathering of COP struggles to keep up with the pace of what is needed. This year, though, we go to COP with a new catalyst for ambition and action. The ICJ's ruling gives us both a compass of telling us what must be done and a yardstick of how we will measure action.
He's heading along to COP with two demands.
First is that the ICJ reiterates that the IPCC is the best available science for global climate policy and states that it must use all the means at their disposal to prevent climate harm. If a policy or a plan is inconsistent with the 1.5 degrees Celsius goal, or it props up fossil fuels, it is on the wrong side of international law. Second, the ICJ confirms that developed countries have a legal obligation to provide finance. That means that the finance outcomes at COP30 are no longer discretionary, but they are part of fulfilling states' legal obligations under international law.
Vanuatu provided support to the students' court case. Despite the ICJ's historic ruling, the country's climate change minister has low expectations of COP30.
Coming into COP, we've got to realise that we're in this global shadow of a period of geopolitical upheaval across the board, militarisation, increasing spending on militarisation, reduction in ODA. We're seeing the tipping points happening in front of our eyes.
Dr. Sindhu Sharma, the international policy lead at the Pacific Islands Climate Action Network, is feeling more hopeful.
We've heard that this is an implementation COP, that this is a COP where we're going to see real shift and change to the right direction, to course correct from the ambition that we have been seeing that is lacking overall.
She said the ICJ ruling could lead to monumental finance decisions.
Last year, we saw a significant failure in finance. And this year, we have the clarity of the court as well in terms of the obligations of countries in terms of what climate finance is. It's not charity, it's an obligation. So seeing how that that can be strengthened, and I think it's this the sort of hardwiring of 1.5 into every room, moving the NDCs from plans to proof and turning like empty funds and into functioning lifelines. So thinking about the fund responding to loss and damage, these are things that we can really see as tangible outcomes of this COP as well, which can lead to greater hope, but are tools that that the clarity of the court has also provided.
The ICJ advisory opinion noted that states that don't take appropriate action to curb emissions may be committing an international wrongful act. Right now in Australia, the federal government is gearing up to introduce an overhaul of the country's environment laws before Parliament. Mr. Reganvanu believes that if the Australian government refuses to consider climate impacts when assessing projects under environmental laws, that will counter the ICJ's finding. Vishal Prasad agrees.
The ICJ is particularly clear in talking about the duty of due diligence, that countries have a duty to ensure that they're doing everything and anything in their power to protect the climate system. And that means having laws, regulations domestically that support or protect the climate system and prevent climate harm. And I think it would be really negligence on Australia's part to not include the findings of the ICJ, not include climate in its considerations. And so really, it does not make sense how you could leave out climate. But our hope is that the final version of this legislation in some way does recognise the clarity from the ICJ on the need to include climate as a way to meet your legal obligation.
Looking ahead, COP30 could see the location of COP31 confirmed. It's a contentious topic as the two countries bidding to host the meeting, Australia and Turkey, are refusing to step aside. Here's Ralph Reganvanu again.
We went to the UNGA in September in New York, where there was a concerted effort to try and bring Australia and Turkey together, and the Pacific Island states were there ready to, and with Australia, to push for this. What happened there is that Turkey didn't allow us to come into the room, so they only allowed Australia to come in and talk, and that opportunity obviously hasn't produced a compromise. Time is running out because this has to be resolved at the COP. Basically, what needs to happen now is that you have the Western Europe and other states group. They need to come up with a unanimous decision. And we have been making our pitch. And really, that's what needs to happen. There needs to be a compromise within that group.
And that there is Ralph Reganvanu, Vanuatu's climate change minister.
Pacific Beat.
Well, we head back to the Solomon Islands, where a new report has found the country is failing to fully comply with its human rights obligations for people with diverse sexual orientations and gender identities under both domestic and international law. It comes as the Solomon Islands prepare for its Universal Periodic Review, a process established by the United Nations Human Rights Council, where the human rights records of UN member states are reviewed. Lucy Cooper spoke with a young woman who shared her experience living as a lesbian in the Solomon Islands.
It's not accepted to be in the LGBTQ community here. It's illegal. So growing up is it's very hard. But I managed to talk to my family about it, how I feel and stuff like that. So they accept it. They are happy with me and everything's okay with my parents' side. So
what kinds of discrimination and or violence have you faced in the Solomon Islands?
I'm open to my family, so, and I open as well on social media. I shared a bit about LGBT on social media, and I get hate over there, like, why are you like this? It's not the right thing to do. It's so, like, people kept posting me on social media about, like, that's very wrong. People never, like, violent towards me, but just on social media I've got so many hates.
And how do people in your community and family respond to your identity?
At first, my family, they see it as it's against our culture and the religions here, so it's kind of difficult for me a bit. But as time goes on, my mom and dad understand, my parents understand me. Just do you, be happy, just do not make people see you as a hate or, yeah, as a bad person for doing that.
If you were to face discrimination or violence in person in the Solomon Islands, do you think you'd feel like you'd be able to report it to the police or seek help?
Because it's illegal, so I can't talk about it to the police about it, like, oh, I am gay and this person do this to me because I am gay. He's telling me to do this or they telling me to do this. I can't. I don't think I can talk to the police about this. I am so glad that some of my friends that are working in the police, they are few of them are in the LGBT community as well, so they might help, or I might need people to help me with that.
If you could change one thing in the Solomon Islands to make life better for people like yourself, what would that be?
This is a very underdeveloped country. There's lack of education, there's lack of employment, there's people still fighting so hard to look for food, stuff like that. So regarding the LGBTQ, it's going to be a bit hard. It's going to be a bit hard for people to understand. It's going to be very hard for people to accept. So through education, we can talk about human rights, or we can teach people about respecting other people's human rights, for example, the LGBTQ human rights.
And to discuss the findings of the report further, we welcome on Pacific Beat Sivan Tacharan, the Senior Advisor of International Policy at Equality Australia. That's one of four groups which authored the report. With that, I say good morning, Sivan, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, Sivan, what was the actual intention for this report?
Well, as we heard, next year, Solomon Islands is up for review on its human rights record at the UN. And we really wanted to ensure that review process was informed by the experiences of LGBTQ plus Solomon Islanders.
Yeah, and I know, Sivan, you would have interviewed, right, for the report that those who have experienced verbal abuse, physical assault, I mean, even economic discrimination and police brutality. I mean, was there any cases of this study that shocked you?
Yeah, there were a few. People do face really widespread and shocking levels of, you know, discrimination, harassment, and even violence in their everyday lives. We did hear about one case where somebody was detained without charge by the police for a few days for being part of the LGBTQ plus community. They were even stripped and mocked by police officers and unfortunately sexually assaulted by another detainee.
And when you and when we look back at the actual report, what's being revealed, you know, about maybe the access to healthcare and education for people with, you know, diverse sexual orientation, gender identity expression, and even sex, you know, sex characteristics?
What we found was that people are being denied basic equality of opportunity across all walks of life. So people are being refused employment, for example, forced out of jobs by their colleagues and bosses, subjected to bullying and harassment in schools and universities. Fortunately, there is one health service that the community finds accepting, you know, but that's just one for the entire country.
Yeah, and we know how big Solomon Islands is. So then with the country failing to fully comply with its human rights obligations for people with, you know, diverse characteristics and whatnot, how does that work under both domestic and international law?
Yeah, so Solomon Islands has signed up to a number of international human rights treaties, and everybody under international human rights law has, you know, the right to live a life of equality and a life free from discrimination. And it's pretty clear that the approach of Solomon Island government is failing to live up to those standards. And similarly, in terms of the spirit of the Solomon Islands Constitution, setting out, you know, fundamental basic rights and freedoms like those we enjoy in Australia, which the experiences we uncovered in our report clearly, you know, are inconsistent with the spirit of those provisions.
So then what are the most urgent legal reforms, Sivan, that are needed in Solomon Islands to basically protect our LGBTQI plus people?
Well, pretty urgently, the Solomon Islands government needs to take steps to decriminalise same-sex relationships. Currently, same-sex relationships carry a penalty of up to 14 years imprisonment, and it's really important that those laws are amended urgently, as well as the introduction of provisions to make sure that trans people can amend their gender markers in their identity documentation, such as birth certificates.
Okay, well, if you've just joined us here on Pacific Beat, we're speaking with Sivan Tetjaran, Senior Advisor of International Policy at Equality Australia, about a new report that finds Solomon Islands is failing to fully comply with its human rights obligations for people with diverse sexual orientations and gender identities. Sivan, when we really look at the issue of daily life of LGBTQI plus individuals, how does the continued criminalisation of same-sex conduct, even if it's not enforced, impact, you know, their lives?
Well, I think it casts a very long shadow over people's lives. It contributes to a culture of, you know, fear and secrecy, just like we just heard. But I do want to stress that, you know, the report found that people also demonstrated incredible resilience, and a lot of LGBTQ plus Solomon Islanders find support from, you know, that one person in their life who accepts them, or that one sports club or that one youth group. And, you know, what that tells us is that it's community at the end of the day that makes the difference for people. And, you know, that change is possible. It's not as entrenched as the laws might suggest.
Mm. Well, because, you know, what does the role of customary law play in perpetuating discrimination? And if so, how can this be addressed?
Well, we heard one story where somebody had been essentially prosecuted for being gay under customary law. But ultimately, change in Solomon Island society and greater acceptance of LGBTQ plus people is going to require leadership, both from the government, but also from customary leaders who are in a position to shift how society interprets customary law.
Sivan, I want to know, because obviously earlier in the piece we'd said, or we're speaking about the fact that Solomon Islands has failed, right, to comply. But how has Solomon Islands responded to previous Universal Periodic Review recommendations?
Well, unfortunately, Solomon Islands government in the past has received a number of recommendations to change its laws regarding LGBTQ plus people. It hasn't accepted any of those recommendations. And in fact, we have seen recent rhetoric from some of the most senior leaders in Solomon Islands against LGBTQ plus people over the last couple of years.
Well, then from that, what then are the top priorities following the release of this report?
Well, as mentioned, there's an urgent need for law reform by the Solomon Islands government. But on the Australian side, the Australian government really needs to step up its overseas aid funding to LGBTIQ plus people in the Pacific. Our aid program plays a critical role in supporting LGBTIQ plus community groups around the region. There is a massive underinvestment. The actual amount going to these communities at the moment is less than a tenth of 1 cent in every Australian aid dollar, and that needs to increase.
Wow. Well, to our listeners who are tuning in this morning, Sivan, what would be your or words like a meaningful inclusion? What would that look like in Solomon Islands in terms of policy and society itself?
Well, I think there needs to be recognition by political leaders in Solomon Islands that LGBTQ plus people are part of Solomon Islands society. And they always have been, just as they are part of every society around the world. That's the starting point, and it's going to be very difficult for us to achieve change without that.
Well, Sivan, thank you so much for coming on the show this morning. Really appreciate that we could have a bit of conversation around this. Hopefully we can catch up again, but thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. That is Sivan Tetcherin, the Senior Advisor of International Policy at Equality Australia.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursdays at 4 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Just giving you a quick recap of what's already been on the show. We spoke about controversy over Solomon Islands wanting to create its own defence force. Pacific leaders and its delegations are arriving armed with a new bargaining chip at this year's COP30. But still to come, Papua New Guinea's long overdue local elections are now underway this week, and a new warning from environmental experts that invasive species in the Pacific are threatening the region's efforts to cope with climate change. But up next, it's your news wrap.
Hold the front page!
Whaftai te lea lava, thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. Yes, it is that time. We head around the region to get the latest headlines. And joining me in the studio this morning is, of course, Whinau Whanua. How are you doing?
I'm good, Aggie. Good morning. How are you?
Well, it's been a while that you've been in this hot seat as the producer. So, look, thank you so much for coming through and hanging out this morning. There's a couple of stories that are, you know, swirling around the Pacific. This one, we start off with Fiji, though. The country's now former Deputy Prime Minister, Biman Prasad, has confirmed that he's been charged with corruption. Oh, goodness. Whinau, what are the local media reporting?
Just the latest politician to be targeted by Fiji's Independent Commission Against Corruption. Fiji Village and Fiji Times reports Professor Biman Prasad, who has resigned as Deputy Prime Minister, he's confirmed that he's being charged for corruption. He didn't say what exactly the corruption charges are, but according to local reports, he's being charged with failing to declare company directorship. The charges related to an early investigation that was concluded in April. And the complaint was lodged by the supervisor of elections. This is just the latest of a number of politicians who are being charged with corruption.
Okay, well, we're still staying in Fiji, though, Finel. There's the HIV crisis that could actually spread across the region, health experts are warning. Could you tell us a little bit more about what they've said?
Yes, according to the Fiji Times, health experts are warning that Fiji's rapidly rising HIV infection rate could spread across the Pacific. This HIV, it's been called a national crisis. And according to Dr. Jalal Mohammed, a senior lecturer at the University of Canterbury and University of Fiji, he says it's reached a tipping point. Fiji's health ministry predicts more than 3,000 new cases to be reported this year. It's one of the reasons for the high number has been because of Bluetoothing, which we've reported on the show before. It's when syringe users share the syringes, yes. and that correlates with the meth epidemic that's occurring there. There's concerns it could spread because Fiji is a major tourism hub.
Yeah, very disturbing about that. Okay, well, we'll keep our eyes and ears on that story. I also know that 105 foreign nationals have been arrested for illegal mining in Papua New Guinea. Where are these nationals actually from then?
According to the national, Chinese nationals, 105, one of whom was a woman, and they were allegedly involved in illegal alluvial mining in Mora Bay's Wau in Bululo province. According to reports, PNG's Immigration and Citizenship Service Authority detained them while they were involved in the illegal mining activities.
Yeah.
According to Chief Migration Officer Wellington Navasivo, they were arrested during a joint operation with police, and it occurred at five illegal mining sites.
Wow. Okay, well, let's see if we can get someone on the show to probably speak about that. But for now, as always, great to have you come on the show, bringing us those headlines from around the Pacific.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now to Papua New Guinea, where their long overdue local level government elections got underway this week after being deferred several times from when they were supposed to be held back in 2022. But as is nearly always the case, PNG elections means drama, particularly in the country's highlands. In Jiwaka province, the Highlands Highway was closed by voters who were angry that illegal LLG wards had been created in some communities. They closed the road while demanding answers from Electoral Commissioner Simon Sinai. The Provincial Police Commander in Mount Hagen says John Sagon says the roads are now reopened and police are on alert so that it remains that way.
The road has been cleared. Yesterday we were walking on the road together with the reinforcement coming in from Southern Islands under the command of Commander Wagambi and myself assisting Commander Wagambi to assist the police in Jiwaka and with my acting assistant commissioner of police Islands Eastern End, together with to clear up the border from the Western Island side border, and down to Jiwaka. Again, we did that early hours of patrol this morning and in ensuring that the road must be free from any hindrance or obstructions. And as I speak, I've just returned back from the morning clearance of the highway and I'm back in Hagen now. Highway is all cleared and it's free for the public to use at this point in time.
Now, is there any reason why the locals in the area blocked the road?
From information that has been gathered in other media outlets, it seems like there's been some it's to do with the polling places where those population at that particular ward council, the average issues that several other polling places were being gazetted. That's why they are not happy. As being the aggrieving party, they decided to take out to the main highway because all these unnecessary roadblocks. But this issue has now been settled, and they should be going for the polls anytime before the end of the week or something. I'm not sure with the arrangement with the Electoral Commission, because Chivaka province is another jurisdiction. It's not within Western Islands, which I can give. However, I can give the update for the polling here in LG elections in Hagen. It's been running smoothly, and we are now going into our third day of the LLG election operations. I am anticipating that the LLG elections should be completed by the weekend. We've got two more districts to complete. That's Tambun Nebilia district and also Hagen Central district. So my talk to the people, we respect the electoral process, which is a constitutional process where they can elect their respective ward councillors and their LLG presidents.
What's your message to the people that are out there, especially people that are there for the wrong intentions? Because a lot of the times we hear people, you know, they move the ballot boxes and ballot papers and all those things. But what would you like to tell the people out there who are with the wrong intentions?
Well, if people are forming those illegal thoughts in their minds about trying to hijack boxes or do double voting, those are corrupt practices which they should avoid as much as they can, because by doing this, that may cause problems, especially the other supporters will. So the good thing is to follow the law.
And according to PPC John Sagon, voting is expected to end this weekend. Now to Samoa, where its new government has passed its budget after weeks of deliberations. It was the inability of the previous government, led by Fia Mayor Naomi Mataafa, to pass a budget that led to the snap election in August and her defeat at the polls. The new government declared a state of economic emergency as it worked out a budget. Now it's been passed, and it's hoped a measure of fiscal stability will return. ABC's Samoa reporter Adele Fruin is on the line. Manuela Tayal, Adele.
Tayal Manuela Aggie, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Great to have you on the show this morning. But hey, look, let's look at this recent, you know, sort of, I understand Samoa's PM is out of the country for medical treatment. But I'm just wondering, did he actually make it back for the passing of his government's budget?
No, he could not make it. So Samoa's Prime Minister, Honourable Lauri Malintopulate Vovosi, was not present in Parliament when his government's budget was recently passed. And, you know, when they passed it, it was late Tuesday evening when they finally, passed their first budget. He's still in New Zealand and receiving medical treatment.
Well, can I ask, though, what are the main priorities highlighted in the government's budget?
Yes. So the new government's budget is focusing on strengthening Samoa's health system and education systems as well. But they're also giving a priority to community development. This is by approving each district to receive 1.8 million during this financial year. So this is an increase from their 1 million tala promise that they made during the 2021 election and how they came into power. Each district received 1 million, but now they've increased it to 1.5 million. You know, this is to support, development, on the grassroots levels and to give the people within the districts opportunities to have their own developments, whether it's agriculture, whether it's, small businesses. So this is their view of, strengthening the country. But not forgetting, they're also increasing social benefits, pension, and also disability payments. These are just some of their promises that they are slowly pushing through their first budget that they recently passed.
But Adele, do we know why it took so long to pass the national budget?
Of course. Now, the government's budget was met with great opposition, of course. While this was for some of the members of the FAST party, they're new to, parliament. And of course, having former Prime Minister Tulu Epotokosailele Malilingoi as the opposition leader, he questioned the inexperience for these members of parliament and also alleged that they were unqualified to run a government. But, this led to heated debates, which eventually led to one member of parliament from the opposition party being suspended. So it was not only a factor of trying to discuss what was happening, within the country with the issues, but they too were also in disagreement about various issues highlighted in the budget. And not just that, another factor that led to the delay was the fact that while, during the first reading of the budget, it was to give an opportunity for members of parliament to share their views on the budget. However, it took, I would say, some members of parliament took over an hour just to do their maiden speech and then share their insights on the budget.
So, look, we spoke about just, why did it take so long to pass? But then we understand also that there really was an urgency to pass the national budget. Why so?
Yes, so the urgency was, as we are all aware, former Prime Minister Fiumina Mimataafa's, government, their budget failed to be passed in Parliament earlier this year. Now, this led, of course, it triggered a snap election. Now, mind you, because the budget was not passed, it meant that a lot of government funding, there was no government funding basically to be operational, and this led to a lot of, workers in government to not be paid, and also their salaries were not being paid. And then also for operational costs, they just had to stop work at certain projects just because there was no funding allocated for that. And the emergency was when the new government came in, they passed an emergency budget. That budget was to cater for 30 days while, they prepared the national budget, and also in the hope they will pass it before the end of 30 days. And, for so many people, they're happy that, the day before the 30-day deadline, they finally passed the budget. And, of course, it also to note that Samoa declared a state of economic emergency. So within that 30 days, we had to operate in very budget constraints, really.
Yeah. And so now that the national budget has been passed, again, we take it back to the people. Like, what is the public saying about this?
Yeah, I've spoken to some members of the public in terms of the public sector, and they are relieved. They feel so much relief that finally they passed the budget, because the whole time they were working, they were worried about getting paid, They were worried about getting delays, with their salaries. They were worried about working, but still there was, uncertainty within, the government because there was no funding. Now, I also spoke to some of the Safata villages, and also, where the Manawanui sinking occurred. These villages were also in anticipation of the budget being passed, because the good news is that the 10 million that was, given by New Zealand government was included in this national budget. And only when the budget is passed, then, they can get some form of financial assistance. So they too welcome the great news. They're just being hopeful and hoping to receive it as soon as possible. As for members of the public, they too have shared their excitement over, the budget, because the budget is catering to, funding the community development projects that they too have been hoping that the government will fund. So, yes.
Well, Adele, it's always great to catch up with you. Thank you so much for keeping us across what's been happening there in Samoa. Whakataitele lava.
Of Tailava Aggie.
That is ABC Samoa reporter Adele Fruin. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. The Solomon Islands Police Minister is pushing for his country to create its own defence force. It's received some support from parliamentarians, but there's mixed public reaction.
The government should consult the people first before making any decision.
Remember, you can find those stories when you type in Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. We'll be back at the same time at 6 a.m. PNG time. But as always, you can listen to us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nija Daily. So until then, o toa o whaato, you've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.